Andrea Daphne Pablo Sanchez Vius Zhu Janiki Yolopakli is of Mexican heritage. For years, she has worked to revitalize ancient indigenous practices. Here in Aotearoa, she shares Temazcal, Kinam, and Tezcatlipoca practices of old central Mexico. She is also a wisdom keeper of ancient Toltec traditions. In this episode, Zhu talks to us about the colonization of Mexico and shares how connecting with wahine Māori challenged and inspired her to refocus her mahi on strengthening Indigenous cultural knowledge and practice. Whakarongo mai. Kia ora, I'm Kiane. Nuku is a movement. We're empowering Indigenous wahine to be agents of change, cultivating opportunities to shape the world we want. Through this series, we're meeting 100 kick-ass Indigenous wahine doing things differently. They show us how the world can be shaped by our unique Indigenous voice. It's all about who we are and not who we've been told to be. Nuku, mahine, mohine, kiahine. Kia ora te whanau, welcome back to another episode of Nuku. We're here back in the Nuku whare. It's really exciting to actually do some of these interviews as we get towards the end of the Nuku Kaupapa back in the Nuku whare, because this is where it all started and this is where the first 10 interviews happened, and so it's almost like the last 10 interviews are not all taking place here, but getting closer and closer to home. It's coming back full circle. Today in the Nuku whare we have the wonderful, and I am going to try really, really hard to pronounce her name correctly, Andrea Daphne Shu, Janiki Yolotpakli, Pablo Sanchez. Tēnā koe.
Tēnā koe, Kiane.
And that is your full name, but you like to go by Shu.
Aye.
Ka whai. Thank you. Yeah. So welcome to my whare, welcome to my papakainga. It is lovely to have you here. You've come over this morning from Waiheke Island. Mm-hmm. How was the ferry ride?
It's really easy and smooth.
Oh, that's good. We're going to talk to you a little bit about why you're currently on Waiheke and living over on that beautiful, gorgeous motu. But before we do, I'm really interested, and as we always start with, really interested to know a little bit more about your whakapapa, where you're from, who you are, where you grew up. So can you share with us a little bit about Shu? Who are you?
Kia ora, Kiane. Tēnā koutou katoa to all the beautiful people that are listening this journey of Nuku. I'm very grateful to be here. And I'll just share a little bit of who I am. So, ko Tlaloc toku Monga, ko Texcoco toku Awa, ko Texcoco, Tenochca, Tenochtitlan, toku whenua. Ko Akolua, Tenochca, toku hapu. Ko Mexica, toku iwi. Ko Xicoa, Tepetoxtli, Xochimistli, toku kalpuli marae. Ko Pablo Sanchez toku whanau. Ko Andrea Daphne Shu Janiki Yolotpakli, Pablo Sanchez toku ingoa. So I am from Mexico, from the central valleys of Mexico, what is today Mexico City. I am 1 hour and a half away of Mexico City, northeast, a place called Texcoco. And that's my lake as well. I'm really central, so we don't really have ocean around us. It's just a lake that comes from my mountain, the water that comes to that lake. It's from 5 volcanoes that are around, and one of them is where I'm whakapapa to, and that's the mountain Tlaloc.
So you grew up in Mexico?
Yeah.
And do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got 3 brothers.
Wow. So only girl?
I'm the only girl.
Were you spoiled as a child for being the only girl?
Super spoiled, because I also didn't grow up with boys as brothers, but also boys' cousins. Yeah. I only had 2 girls' cousins from my dad's side, and that family was the only one that wasn't close to us. The rest of the family, we always live close by until today. And from my mom's side, at that time, I didn't have any cousins because she only has one brother.
Mm.
So I pretty much just grew up with boys and being the daddy's princess. So, yeah. Beautiful men, though. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about growing up in Mexico. I've never been. I have only seen what I see on television or in movies. What is it like to grow up in Mexico? What is it like to be in that space in the world today?
Well, that's just like a question that takes me into like this like past future spaceship kind of thing. I'm very grateful that my time growing up in Texcoco was really healthy, I would say. I felt really privileged to have been able to grow up amongst all my cousins, that we were all just on the same road or just within the same blocks. And at that point was really healthy and safe, I would say, as some of the key points. Because unfortunately for the kids growing up there today is not safe anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the days when I grew up, it was still kind of the countryside of Mexico City. There were a lot of farms. And I can imagine when my mom grew up there, like the lake, like people were still fish at the lakes. Whereas when I grew up, that lake was already closed and polluted. And today it's just kind of just become like an extension of Mexico City, and not necessarily a beautiful extension. It's really like overcrowded, lots of people moving in, overpopulated, really unsafe. Unfortunately, with the drug cartels moving in. So there's, for kids growing up there, it's, I would say it's quite difficult because there's this fear of kidnapping or just, yeah, not really positive things. So I'm really grateful and lucky that when I grew up, it was still a safe place where I could just run around with my cousins, play with the mud and just be out for the whole day if I wanted to.
When you were young, how did your whānau teach you about your indigenous culture?
Well, actually, I grew up in a very Catholicized family.
Mm.
I kind of have the typical story of maybe three generations that been fully colonized and fully taken Catholicism. And I did grow up in a Mexico that was racism towards indigenous culture, towards our own indigenous culture, which the culture itself was embracing us as Mexicans to become a white culture, to speak English, to get like creams that light your skin.
Wow.
The English, you know, just they're like, you're gonna be better off of learning English if you wanna be someone and forget about the native language and anything of the native culture, because that's just something from the past. So sadly, my parents were part still of that three generations. However, my dad did gave me the freedom to choose. The religion wasn't enforced to me. It was always like, hey, your grandparents practice this, and that what makes them happy, that what brings them hope, and we have to respect that, but you don't have to follow the same steps. If you want to be praying to a rock, or if you want to be praying to Bob Marley, just whatever makes you happy, it's just whatever helps you to keep hope and that a reminder that your dreams can come true.
Mm.
It's in your heart and you are your own sovereign being. So I did grow up with mom and dad who were quite liberal, I would say, amongst my friends or my circle. So my mom is a fashion designer, so I was always free to explore and express different forms. And my dad is a hydrobiologist, so it was more bringing that connection to the environment and, to look after the environment. And I guess the indigenous call was always within me. Like every time we went to Mexico City, and I'll be able to see the ceremonies being carried on in the plaza, in the main square. It was just my heart will just like, it's like sniffing all that, just the smoke, the drum, like, oh, it's just like, I just had that call that I just wanted to be present in those spaces.
And because I think, you know, from the perspective of people who don't live in countries like Mexico, we assume that if someone speaks Spanish and lives in their country, that's them expressing their indigeneity. Mm. But actually, the indigeneity is much deeper than that. Mm. And are there indigenous languages that are specific to different tribes or different? You know, you talk about your maunga and there being five maunga that feed into this lake. Are there different languages, indigenous languages within Mexico?
Yes, there is. And I'm so grateful that you asked this because, I agree that's a very common connotation for a lot of people when they think of Mexicans. I think it has become like an overall mixed culture of what is to be Mexican today, which often forgets the spiritual side of it, which the spiritual side is totally connected to the indigenous culture. So from where I'm from, like central Mexico, is the Nahua people, the Mexica people, better known today as the Aztec, which is something that, again, most people would think like Aztecs were like a culture from the past. But actually it is still the people that are still trying to revive that culture, and it's the Mexica people. So I'm Mexica, and the Aztec actually came from the misunderstanding of Spanish colonizers arriving to Mexico. Wow. That they told that the people were Aztecs, but actually is the Mexica people. So the language of central Mexico is Nahuatl, but there is like around 250 different native languages around Mexico.
So what languages did you grow up with?
I grew up with Spanish and English at school, yeah.
And was there an understanding when you were a child that you weren't speaking your indigenous language, that you were speaking Spanish? Like, did you understand that there was a difference back then when you were a child?
Yes and no. I think my only understanding was that it was really caught to me. Like it was almost like I have no relation to the indigenous aspects. Like that was really something that had been buried with the undeveloped world kind of thing. Like all of that is not going anywhere in the future. It's just death. So that was my understanding. Even at school with the history classes, it always seemed like something really, really ancient, almost from a movie that, yeah, like today it was to be Mexican, and that was just like a conglomeration of what it used to be and where it's going, and that's it. Yeah.
So if you've talked, you've mentioned that the Spanish colonization of Mexico, but you also have the influence of the United States of America right on your borders.
Yeah.
And that's huge.
Yeah.
And America has such a huge influence on Mexico in so many ways, so many of them incredibly negative and incredibly destructive. Mm. Tell me a little bit about that.
I'm just feeling the fire and the water's coming out of my eyes. Because yes, it is. Yeah, it is something that once it really came to my awareness, it just made me so angry to have grown up in that culture of just having the Spanish just been fully killing everything, and then the new culture kind of just wanting to take the English culture.
Mm.
So it is really sad because a lot of the land, it's been pretty much sold out to the States. But also there is a hope, like just going back a little bit to some of your earlier questions. Since I was little, I was always amazed by National Geographic documentaries on indigenous peoples. And like I said, like every time that I went to the city and experienced some of these rituals, it was like this nostalgic feeling inside me, even since I was little, like a dream, like I wish I was part of that. Like I wish my family had this. So like now that I'm like more, like now that I know that I'm not alienated from that actually that's me, and I'm able, and by connecting through my ancestors, by calling them, I've been able to recall that back into my life. There is this certain hope, but it is a challenge. It is like a living war. Where the violence is really subtle, like it just keeps taking over the people. And sometimes that's one of my major confusions in life, like being here in Aotearoa, being that far, but being able to go deeper in somewhere or another really slow because of the distance. I suppose when I'm there, it's like the culture that is taking over, it's like right on your face. But it's also so beautiful when I'm there just to keep anchoring more and more with the people that have been holding that, and that every day they still like fighting to preserve that. And knowing that a lot of Mexicans themselves would still judge them because there's still racism towards that.
And that's the thing that's really fascinates me when we think about colonization. And, you know, there's this common kōrero that, you know, the colonizer has won when the people begin to turn on themselves, you know, when they start to see their own peers and their own whānau as less than. And when you think about Spanish colonization of Mexico, American colonization of Mexico, and then Mexicans, you know, just disregarding their heritage and their indigenous connections, it makes me feel really, I mean, I can see it in you already that you feel extremely distraught about the reality of life at the moment in your country, and it makes me feel extremely sad to think that it's such a hard fight, because you're not just fighting the colonizers that are obviously colonizing, but you're also fighting your own or against your own to try and preserve something that should be thriving amongst them. And you talked a little bit about drug cartels. I know nothing about drug cartels. This is not even a subject that I can even start talking about, aside from what I see on American TV shows. But I can only imagine that that again completely changes culture. Because it's not just, you know, we think about these things that happen, like crimes that happen, but this is a whole new culture, a whole new way of being that has its own tikanga about it that is, you know, I can see you getting upset in the way that I'm talking, and I don't want to like put it all down into this very horrible cesspit of negativity. But I guess it's just us as Māori and us as Pacifica and us here in Aotearoa really trying to understand the realities of Indigenous peoples in other countries. And I think, you know, as I did say, a lot of the time we see, these people are Mexican, they live on their land, they speak what we assume is their language but is not, but don't necessarily have that connection to Indigenous practice and culture. You came to New Zealand for university, is that right?
Yeah.
How many years ago was that?
That was 16 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've been here for a while.
Yeah, I came here in 2005, October 2005.
And I like this, you said, and I'm going to get to this point, but your dad said, I sent you all the way to New Zealand to do a degree only for you to come back home to Mexico to want to learn your native tongue and reconnect with your Indigenous ways. And so I want to kind of start with that journey to New Zealand. What did you come here to study?
Well, I came here to study photography.
Oh, yeah.
but there were two underlying stories in there. Like, one was I wanted to be a photographer because my dream was to work for the National Geographic and just travel photographing Indigenous peoples. And then that was one. So for me, coming to New Zealand was specifically to connect with Maori culture. I didn't know anything about New Zealand or Maori culture. So when the offer was there from my parents, my option was Australia, because I've always been fascinated by Indigenous Australian people. And so I really wanted to go there, and that was the plan. And when I went to to ask for information, the group of Australasia, they introduced me to New Zealand. It's like, oh, just from what you are like trying to do, maybe New Zealand would be better for you because Maori culture is a bit more accessible as opposed to that of Indigenous Australia. Mm. So that was one line. And then also for my dad, I guess, as being maybe his only daughter and just seeing how the country, it's been going in terms of on safety. It just happened that as well, at that point, I had my first assault. I got assaulted in Mexico. And I remember from that moment, like, I mean, my dad always told me, when you grow up, I want you out of Mexico. And that time when I experienced that assault, he was like, okay, I found flights to New Zealand. When do you want to go? Do you want to go on Tuesday or Saturday? I was like, whoa, and it's like Sunday today, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like in 3 days, no, next Saturday. So yeah, just kind of just end up coming here and just study photography, but mainly I've had like that strong connection to wanting to connect with Maori culture because it seemed to be that it was alive and I was curious on it, yeah.
And so did you come to study photography?
Yeah, I came to Massey University.
Oh, yeah.
And did my Bachelor of Photographic Design there. Graduated with honours and... yeah,
well done.
Sadly for my dad, when I finished, I was like, I'm not doing photography. So he was really like, what? But yes, that's just how it is.
So I take it that when you got here and you did your study, it was your connection with Te Ao Māori that actually inspired and ignited a different flame within you to then want to reconnect with your Indigenous practices. So did you go home to Mexico to learn those Indigenous practices with the understanding that you were coming back to New Zealand, or did you think you were going to go back to Mexico and kind of do that mahi there?
It took a long time, you know. I was here for 7 years without going back home. Again, one of the, I guess I always kind of knew like going out of home was to try to find a better life somewhere else. Mm. So I guess that was like me trying to fill in all the immigration requirements to get that paper easier. And part of that was maybe for me not to leave the country at all.
Yeah.
So I was in New Zealand for 7 years and it was a journey of connecting more and more with Te Ao Māori until eventually, yeah, I got my residency and it seemed like life put all the stones guiding the path along the way, putting the right people at the right time until I got my residency. And then at that point, I was living with these three amazing Maori wahine that speak Fultereo. They were all my age, amazing friends of mine. And then they're all artists. And then also I ended up traveling with another kuia for like 2 weeks. And at the end of that journey, she was the one that said, like, hey, you know, your tangata whenua, this is your home, but your kite is empty. You need to go home, back home to Mexico, to your ancestors, because your tupuna is waiting there for you to give you something. And then when you come back, you have something to share with us. Because at this moment, you've been unable to share. So that was like a really strong tohu for me. And also, it just happened that maybe 2 years before that, I also came across this beautiful grandfather from Brazil, Paulo Prieto. He's the first person that offered me a ceremony as such, just like a personal ceremony, just me and him. And he also mentioned the same. He said, like, you need to go home. Like, your ancestors are there and there's so much that you're going to be given. And let me know when you go home because I can take you to the right people. I go to Mexico every year. And yeah, eventually it happened. And when I went back home, it was like, I was totally like excited about like, and curious and like, where am I going to find all these things? And as soon as I got home, I just told everyone that knew me, my parents, my friends, everyone, like, I want to experience this and I want to do this. And it just seemed like the door just opened up and everything was there waiting. Yeah.
I love that. Your tupuna were waiting. Tell me about some of the practices and the traditions that you have, that you learnt when you went home and that you have brought back to Aotearoa and are keeping alive through your practice and working, doing this mahi on Waiheke. Mm. Tell me about what some of these practices are.
Yeah, so the first one that pops in is the one that I'm fully sharing a lot here in Aotearoa on Waiheke, which is the Temazcal, which is a sweat lodge. So it is a dome structure that is built on the ground itself. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of similar of a sauna, but that like of a really ancient sauna. So it's like an igloo shape, and we go inside and we bring in hot volcanic rocks, similar to those that you use for the hangi. Mm-hmm. And then we prepare this herbal water, and then we bring it in and we splash the rocks with the water, and that way that creates the sweat. But inside this structure, which represents the belly, the pregnant belly of the Mother Earth, it's pitch dark inside. So when we go in, it has different symbols and meanings. So the belly represents the womb of the mother. And then the fire where the rocks are heated that sits outside of the lodge represents the father's son. So when the rocks come in one way, they represent the sperm. Mm. And once they are inside, they represent the ancestors. So the intention of going inside the Temazcal is that of rebirthing. So culturally, we believe that as much as we need individual cleansings, like we need to be cleaning ourselves all the time, we believe it's really important to have those like collective cleansings with our whanaos, with our communities, just to clear up emotional dramas or thoughts that we go through as human beings on our daily lives. So that gives us like a space for us to release and keep clearing the connections within our people. And so most people that will practice, that will still follow traditional practices in Mexico, it's really common that they'll have a sweat lodge in their house, a temazcal. Kind of as they build a kitchen or a toilet, they will build a temazcal in their house for their families, and that sweat lodge will be lit like at least once a month, just to keep it active. And the neighborhood is always invited to come. So I like to say that even before I came to New Zealand, when I was in high school, I had lots of friends that will say like they were going to the Temazcal. And I was always curious about it, but it was like, I don't know, like no one in my family does that. Like, and so before I went back to Mexico, that was one of the first things that I was like, I really want to go and experience the Temazcal. So when I first arrived there and I entered my first Temazcal, like I was like, I just see myself though in this, like I just loved it. It was just so, I just felt was so within me that that was something that I was just gonna be doing for the rest of my life maybe, yeah.
So you share it with different people of different cultures. How have others responded to the Temazcal and to the work that you're doing?
Well, it's been amazing. I'd like to share a little story about it. Because when I went back to Mexico and connected to this grandmother, Yolmo, and grandfather, Huitzilin Colibri, who that's what I call one of my marais, the Kalpuli Xicot Tepetoxtli, which that's one of my lineages where I always go back when I'm in Mexico. There was a strong connection between us already, because through one of my old friends when I was a teenager that was connected to them. So they welcomed me really well into their kalpuli, which is their hapu. And they started teaching me, and they knew that I was going to come back to New Zealand. So they felt like this grandmother, she really felt like, okay, you've got like a really strong mission, and it's going to be a challenging mission for you because you are alone there. And you know, this is a path that you're just gonna be walking forever. It's not like a teaching course and that's it. It's a path. And the grandfather told me, I don't know what are you visioning with wanting to learn all this, but the only thing that you're gonna get out of all of this is humility and to learn to walk with humbleness and to remember that you can learn from everyone. And so as part of that, they also took me to become a dancer of Xochimilco, which is another practice that I walk now, which is a moon dance. And within that moon dance, my first ceremony at that moon dance at night, I had a vision. We danced for 4 nights, fully fasting, like fasting for 4 nights, and we're going to sweat lodges. And within that dance, I started having visions. And one of those visions was that that I was gonna be in New Zealand sharing something from my culture, and then something from New Zealand was gonna come to Mexico. And at that point for me, it was like I saw Hongoe Kamarai, even though I haven't been there, but I just knew that name, and I thought it was that I saw in my vision, which is in Plymouthton, Wellington. Mm-hmm. And a sense of peace came into my being, because I was, before that I was confused, like, I'm not gonna be a photographer, I'm kind of lost on my path, like, I don't know what I'm doing. But when I had that vision, it was like, oh, like, okay, I don't need to worry, spirit is taking after me, looking after me, so I just need to be aware and just keep walking. And so, after being in Mexico doing those sweat lodges and going to that moon dance, I came back to New Zealand, and my friend Widemu Grace from Ngāti Porou, he invited me to Hongwai Kamarai, because he was organizing this event called Conscious Roots Festival. Mm-hmm. And what he wanted to bring was people from different indigenous practices to come and share something to his people, to the whānau around that area. So I said, yeah. So he said, I'd like to invite you to bring something from Mexico. Would you be interested? I was like, fuck yeah. Like, this is like, yeah. It's like, what do you want to bring? And I was like, temazcal. I was like, okay, what does that involve? And then when I share everything that involves, he's like, okay, that's going to be challenging, but we'll make the most to make it happen, because that involved making a fire, mm-hmm. At the marae from a different culture. There were different layers that he had to go and face through his iwi, through his hapu, through the land there as well, energetically, mm-hmm. and everything. And when the time was getting closer, I was like, holy shit, like, how am I gonna do this by myself? Like, at home is like a whole family that runs the sweat lodge, the temazcal. And here, like, I'm the only one that knows, familiar to it. And so I had lots of friends that pop in, like, we'll help you, tell us what to do. And then I was like, okay, I just need the elders. Like, I need some like poles that are actually connected to the land. So my friend Piki Huia, she contacted me with her aunties, amazing witches, Hemaima Grace and Shailene Mawate. And they were like, they already knew what I was doing. And they're like, okay, girl, don't worry. We don't know what you're doing, but we've got your plans. They've been under the full moon. We're going to be there with you. Like, we got to meet this day. And don't worry, we all sorted. You're looked after. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, cool. And when we did the sweat, I was just crying, because that was the vision that I had when I was in the moon dance. And just to be living that as an exchange with Maori as well was really powerful. And I think what I saw for me in that moment, to bring the fire back to that place, was it's been still like a gift, a taonga for me, because the place where we did the fire, it used to be a fire pit, but there hasn't been a fire there for so long, and it was all covered with like beers and rubbish, and but that just seemed to be the safest place to put a fire if we wanted to put a fire. So then when my friend Widemu asked, he's like, oh, are you going to be okay if we do the fire there? I was like, I think this is the perfect place. We just need, this is a fire pit, and it's not a rubbish bin. Mm. So it just felt amazing to have all the tamariki there helping, clearing, and yeah, it was amazing.
How beautiful. When you talk about dance and you talk about the full moon dance, can you tell me a little bit about your indigenous relationship with the moon? Because in Te Ao Māori, we have a relationship with the marama, mm-hmm. and we use it as, the marama is part of our marama taka, so it's our a marker of time, but you know, we have different pūrākau, different stories about the moon, and the different phases of the moon affect the different energies that are here. And that's we're familiar with it in Te Ao Māori, and we're also slowly getting more familiar with it across the Pacific. What is your connection with the moon?
It just goes really deep, and I'm still learning from it. And the most amazing thing for me is the whole name of where I'm from, Mexico, or Mexico, but in Nahuatl, in the native tongue, it's pronounced Mexico, and it's composed of two words, me from Mixtli, which it's Marama. So Mixtli is the moon, and Xico is the pito, is the belly bottom. So Mexico or Mexico means the belly bottom or the root of the moon. And I think it has to do because we are right in the equator. So it has something to do with that, that our ancestors saw with the movements, the astrological movements, but I'm still really a baby on those arts. But with the moon dance, it's been amazing for me to reconnect with that because we are given tools at the moon dance. One of those ones is the peace pipe. And with this peace pipe as woman, because this dance is specifically just for women. So I think and I feel that all what the moon dance is bringing to us as women is to start remembering what's our connection with the moon, because the moon dance itself is all about the cycles of the moon. So we carry this pipe for us to start connecting with the moon. With the cycles, and we light the pipe with our fire once a month whenever a woman chooses to light the pipe, and we pray with this pipe. So we're going deeper and deeper on what it is actually, what does this mean for us to be cyclic, to understand our nature as women, what is our role in our community, what is our role energetically with the earth, and
We recently had a Nuku interview, kōrero with Dr. Ngahuia Murphy, and she talked a lot about the power of ceremony and the power of ceremony for women and what ceremony looks like to us as individuals and how we need to be reclaiming ceremony. You also have a drum circle. And so we've got the Sweat Lodge, we've got the dance, we've got drum circle. What can you tell me a little bit about the drum circle, and can you tell me about the importance of ceremony and how you're interweaving Mexican and Maori culture through ceremony?
I feel like it's all interwoven, and I that's something that I love about Indigenous ways, like going back to the circle, and the drum is that. Me, it is a circle, and is the heartbeat. So the drum that we have here in New Zealand is called Yolotpakli, and comes from that root of Xochimilco, the moon dance. And I've been part of the chanting group there for the past 6 years. And so, because I don't live in Mexico, I feel like I'm missing a lot of the responsibilities or the learnings. So a couple of years ago, I asked the grandmother if I was able to bring a drum here to New Zealand to share with the people that were already practicing some of those practices from that part of the world. And she granted the permission, so we brought this drum. And so it is a form of prayer, and it is connecting with the heartbeat. Like, the heartbeat is just really simple. It doesn't really have many rhythms or anything. It's just one single beat, and it's to recalibrate our heartbeat with the heartbeat of the earth, and within that, share our prayer in circle.
Yeah. I love that. I love that, to recalibrate our heartbeat with the heartbeat of the earth. That is so powerful.
Yeah.
It is so powerful. When we think about being here in Aotearoa and your, I guess, being so far away from home, how has Te Ao Māori continued to inspire you through the current pathway you're on? Because I know that it inspired you to go home and to bring these practices back to life for your world and your family. How has Te Ao Māori continued to inspire you while you've been here?
To be honest, it's always kind of inspiring, I think, just because of the way of living. Mm. But it just, I just reached moments in my life that I just have to surrender to the great mystery, and it's like, I don't even know, like, I'm just being like a puppet with the strings being moved from above and from below. Because I know there's still so many journeys to still go back home, and I still, like, in visions, I still see lots of, I feel it's like traveling way, way back in the days when all of our ancestors were, like, traveling and exchanging. And at times it feels like it's just like, I'm just seeing myself, like, it hasn't changed. We're still carrying on with this path. And that's the responsibility of keep sharing, but keep sharing this taonga with the integrity and the sacredness that it has. So it can help others, so it can help recalibrate or rebalance our stance on earth for everything that we've been going out of the line. Yeah. Mm.
A lot of the practices, and especially our Indigenous practices that we both share, that we all can share, a lot of our practices are about balance and rebalancing ourselves and rebalancing our lives and the craziness of the world that we live in today, and pulling us back into our Indigenous practice so that we can be tau, we can find that sense of balance. When you look at the world that we live in today and you look at the way that women, Indigenous women, lead their lives, what's your whakaaro? What do you think about how we are in the world and the importance of balance when it comes to taking care of ourselves? Because a lot of us are really bad at that.
Well, I feel like, you know, our wharetanga da, like, we are the birth givers. So we're going to give birth to whatever we want to give birth to. And that's something that is so important for us to tune in with ourselves as women, to look after our vaginas, literally, to look after our yoni, after our bodies, to teach the young woman the sacredness of their bodies so they are aware of who they are letting in inside their bodies, and also what it is to become pregnant, that not necessarily needs to be a physical pregnant of delivering a baby, but actually by attuning ourselves back to the moon, like, how, you know, how can we use these cyclic energies of our moon cycle to create and give birth to the new life that, it's really for us as women to reclaim the power that we have and become responsible and humble with it to create. Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about a number of women who have been a part of your life, but who is an Indigenous woman that has inspired you?
I do. In modern life, I would like to acknowledge my friend Piki Huia, who is just a modern contemporary Maori being, and I've seen her struggle, and I've seen her fight of whatever she will, the first thing that she'll claim for herself is to be Maori. And I was always inspired by her fire, like all the anger and the trauma that she carries, but I can just see her ancestors and her, like, bring it forward, like, speaking her lingua, she's standing strong no matter how people may be upset about what she says, like, and just the way she expresses through her art, through her clothing, through her being, through her family, through her friends, who she is. That's always been inspiring for me, especially because I see her, like, as a reflection, like, oh, like, that could be me. That could be a lot of my age people in Mexico, that we could be reclaiming who we are as Indigenous women, as Indigenous people. And also, one person that was not of my times, Maria Sabina, who was He's a well-known curandera healer from Mexico. She was from the mountains of Oaxaca. And lots of people from all over the place, including elders from like Pink Floyd and lots of musicians from that era, went and see her for her knowledge and her medicine. And every time I see videos of her, or because she hardly speaks Spanish, and she's just like this really old grandma just in the mountains, like separating her chilies and her beans and her corn in like very like humble, earthy house. But yet she just became really well known, and lots of people will go for just to be with her and listen to her wisdom, her songs, even though she didn't speak English or Spanish. Yeah. So just when I see photos of her, there's something that I just feel like the heart. It's just, yeah, the love of a grandmother. Yeah.
What does it mean to be an Indigenous woman today? I guess when I ask you that, I think about it from a global perspective, because you've had the privilege of being an Indigenous woman in your homeland and also being an Indigenous woman in another country and still being able to practice your ceremonies as an Indigenous woman. But what does it mean and look like to be an Indigenous woman today?
For me, I would say that it's hard. It is hard because there's the respect and the humility of carrying something so powerful that it could be broken so easily and disrespected so easily, and that it's been, that it seems that have been broken and disrespected for so long. So at times it feels like it's like the whole body and everything just tightens up because it just wants to protect it. But then also it's like, I feel like being an Indigenous woman today, it's the gift of finding balance, because we have all the tools to find that balance of starting to release the tighten up of the body of Indigenous, to slowly releasing, to open up and slowly open that, like opening up that flower of knowledge again. But for people to, it's our responsibility to look after it so people can see the delicacy of that flower that's just about to open up again, that's only going to bring beauty into this world. But it's so sacred. So, yeah, I feel it's hard and it's precious.
It's hard and precious. Both of those things. I look at some of the taonga that you have bought today that you're going to wear as part of the photos that we're going to take. And I look at the beautiful taonga that you're wearing now as we speak, and you have beaded necklace and beaded earring and feathers. Are these part of... Because when we think about beading, in Aotearoa we have pounamu and we have carving and weaving, and so those are our, I guess... jewelry, for want of a better word. Are the beads of your Indigenous homeland, and are these part of your culture?
Yeah, so the beads, they're not directly from my hapu or from my iwi. It's a different iwi that goes more like northern mountains of Mexico, which is the Wirarica people. And the Wirarica people are some of the groups in Mexico that have managed to preserve more of their language and their traditions, as opposed to that of the Nahua people in central Mexico. And that's also been like a very inspiring inspiring culture for me that I always look at to learn and to get inspired. So... they definitely bring me a connection to my whakapapa. In central Mexico, it's really amazing because a lot of our stones, it's also for that used to be used for jewelry, is the jade and the turquoise and the obsidian. But unfortunately, and that's something that, I don't know, I'll leave it to New Zealanders to think about, but it's been quite a long time for Mexico now, but a lot of our jade has been exploited. and so is our turquoise. So it's really difficult today to find jade and turquoise from Mexico. But within the region that I'm from, we have the obsidian really strong, and sometimes I use those stones as part of my attire, but it's really when it's really needed, because it can be like a really strong, powerful tool to be carrying on the face of people. Yeah.
Wow. And because the obsidian is black?
Yeah.
And I think we sometimes, you know, we think about Pounamu and the power and the significance and the spiritual connection that we can have with Pounamu. Mm-hmm. And I have whakapapa to the Cook Islands, and so we have black pearls, and that has a similar significance in my family, especially with how we, you know, wear our taonga to keep us safe and keep us protected. Mm. And so, obsidian is, I can imagine the power behind that one. Have you ever been to Aotea, Great Barrier Island?
Yes, I've just recently been there.
Oh, yeah, because I was there for a totally different job, and I was privileged to go for a hikoi at one of the maunga, and they were talking to me about the obsidian on one of the maunga, and it's part of a pūrako that the local iwi have there. I didn't get to go and see the obsidian, but it was just a beautiful story that I don't think even, you know, many of us realise some of the significance of these stones that we have in Aotearoa to our whakapapa. And it's amazing how it can, you know, like how it connects. Like you have the jade, we have Pounamu jade. There's so much deeper connection that we have between our people that until we actually open up those kōrero and explore them at that level.
Yeah, it always amazes me. That's why sometimes I'm like, there's just something that I just still don't know, but I know in a cellular level, but I don't know it in words. Like, how is that connection? Because I do find, lots of similarities in,
And I think that's the beauty of, you know, one of the things I've thoroughly enjoyed through this whole series of Nuku is every single wahine is different. And some come from what we might assume to be completely different backgrounds, like you and I wouldn't necessarily think that we had a lot in common. But when we actually boil it right down and talk about our Indigenous connections, we are so similar. You know, the things that we value, the spiritual practices that we have, the reasons for having them, the taonga that we have, you know, it is just so similar. And I think it's really beautiful to be able to find those similarities and really help us to understand that indigenizing, because we talk about decolonization, or you know, decolonizing, indigenizing actually brings us right back down to our rawest, purest form, which allows us to really think about the connections that our tupuna must have had. Because surely our tupuna would have met.
Totally. I know that for sure. Yeah, I feel it's like an embodiment. And I guess for me, you know, like the use of feathers, like this was a gift from two friends of mine recently, that another vision kind of came to fruition. And because I wasn't able to go to Mexico for the moon dance, we ended up dancing here with a beautiful kuia that I end up meeting that has, she's Maori herself, but she has like this really strong connection with Native American people. And she carries the pipe, and when we met, I was carrying my obsidian pipe, and she had a redstone pipe from the United States, but also she had a Pounamu pipe. So that was for me like, well, that's like, you're like the person I've been looking for. Like, it just has this weaved connection already in which she's weaving both practices. So we were able to dance here in New Zealand last year, as I wasn't able to go to Mexico. And this was one of the gifts that came after the whole ceremony. So I guess, to bring these tools or these attires, these regalia, is a reminder of our ancestors. Like, I don't know, for me, the feathers is that. It's like wherever I go in my daily days, don't remember that there's a higher vision. So don't take it everything personal. So, you know, if I'm there and like the wind starts blowing, I could just hear it's like, it's like just reminders, you know, and like just to keep grounded and humble that there's like, to be aware of all the signs that are there constantly.
That's beautiful. My last pātai for you, my last question is, what is your hope for the future of Indigenous women?
My hope for all Indigenous women worldwide is to be fully recognised, to be able to stand strong and in balance, like with all of our femininity as well, because I feel like today, for a lot of us as Indigenous women, we have become really hardened. Almost our, like, our masculine warrior is so protecting ourselves that we've become so tight. So I wish for all Indigenous women to be able to stand in balance on the earth, to be here, to be listening, and to be recognized for the wisdom that we have for this, yeah, as earth, because we are the earth ourselves.
That is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing today. Thank you for giving us just the smallest insight into who you are, into your cultural heritage, into the ceremonies and practices of your Indigenous people. And I think that it is so important that we remember that, you know, even some of the cultures around the world that we think have their connections to their Indigenous heritage intact actually is not the case, and we need to be looking and thinking a little bit deeper than what we see on the surface. Yeah. And so thank you for bringing that to light, for sharing that kōrero, and for holding on to the mahi that you do. I know that it can't be easy doing it away from home and doing it here in Aotearoa, but I'm so glad you have found a space here that you're able to share, and that, you know, the tikanga that you bring and the kaupapa that you bring here and what we have here in Aotearoa as Māori, we're able to blend that together and all the powerful fires burning.
Yes. Thank you.
I just want to remind everybody before we go that the Nuku Puka Puka is coming out very soon. You can pre-order your copy at nukuwoman.co.nz. It features all 100 of our amazing Nuku Wahine. It is a taonga to share for yourself, for your whānau, for your friends, and most importantly for our tamariki and our mukapuna, so that they can see 100 Indigenous female leaders, change makers, amazing kikas, Indigenous wahine, who can inspire them throughout the rest of their lives. So,
tēnā koe. I just want to say really quickly thank you to my papa, Jesus Enrique Pablo Dorantes, and my mama, Blanca Estela Sanchez Delgadillo. I love you.
Oh, beautiful. Don't forget, whānau, our book, Nuku, Stories of 100 Indigenous Women, is currently available on pre-order. Make sure you grab yourself a copy. Want to know more about our book? Nuku, Stories of 100 Indigenous Women is a powerful and important snapshot of Indigenous wahine today. Through wide-ranging voices, this ambitious social documentary allows you to obtain authentic insight into life as an Indigenous wahine in a way like never before. The stories recorded are of incredible wahine. Each offers significance to the story of mana wahine. From Oscar-nominated filmmakers and award-winning musicians, to scientists, entrepreneurs, tribal leaders, artists, environmental champions, knowledge holders, mothers, and more. These Nuku wahine seek to influence the world around them. The youngest is 14 and the eldest is in her mid-70s. They are wahine Māori, Moriori, Pasifika, Melanesian, Wiradjuri, Himalayan, and Mexican. Order your copy today at www.nukuwoman.co.nz.